starting a new life in Australia isn't easy.
A lot of companies have rejected me.
Sometimes I feel like, oh, I'm gonna quit, I've given up.
Work in Progress is a podcast to help skilled migrants rebuild their careers in a new country. You'll hear inspiring real-life stories, expert advice, and valuable tips to help you find a job and advance your career. Work in Progress. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Bonjour, bonjour, bonjour. Welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast for another week of diving into this great sport that we all love, cycling. And we have a special guest today. But first of all, we have, of course, the whole crew is with us. And Grace, you're back with us. How are you, Grace, this week?
Yeah, back. I didn't really go anywhere, but here I am.
Well, you went everywhere in January, so you allowed a little bit of rest.
Yeah, of course. I agree.
The man that was everywhere as well in January is, of course, Maka. Maka, welcome back to the studios.
Very good to be. We have a full house today.
Yes,
I noticed we've got lighting. We've got all sorts of things. What's going on?
Everything. We have a special guest.
We do.
We all heard his name retiring this year. We're so pleased to talk to him in our studios. It's Simon Clark. Simon, how are you? Welcome back to the SBS Cycling Podcast.
G'day. Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me. And it's great to be back on the podcast again.
Big moment for you, I guess, that you were thinking about it most part of last year, 2025, and it has finally happened. You are officially retired. How's that feel?
Yeah, I mean, we were just chatting before. It feels great, you know, waking up in the morning and not thinking about how many calories you need to eat for breakfast and how many hours on the bike every day is a nice way to wake up in the morning. So I've had a bit over a week to get used to that, and it's going well.
Yeah, happy so far with the decision. On your right, you've got Grace Brown, which is amongst all us the most recently retired, except you, before your time. Any advice to give him a year in?
I guess enjoy this like first part of the retirement experience, because a lot of athletes, I think, are looking to the next thing already. And I know like that I couldn't help it but think about what am I doing next. But treat it as like an off season without an ending for a little while, I think.
Yeah, I feel like as athletes, you're just wired to do something. And so to do absolutely nothing, I suppose, if you've done it for so long, feels a bit foreign for us.
That's where you talk to me. I'm super good at doing nothing.
He's the king. I'm trying to chase him.
I'm procrastinator.
So, I purposely delayed my return to Europe by a couple of weeks after Cadell's race, just to give me a window of decompression. And then once I step back to Europe, things will kick off again.
They are kicking off because you've also announced, and it's been a bit of a soft announcement, that you're staying with NSN in a pretty important role, aren't you? So you're sort of going to be pretty busy once you get back.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, it's been a bit over a year of me already doing this role, which is working with material optimization, performance, aerodynamics, all that kind of stuff. I suppose I just drop the riding side and continue with what I've been doing. But in a way, it's been great because I already have an idea of what I'm stepping into, and I'm not going into something I have don't know what a day-to-day operations look like. And at the same time, I was doing things last year which I would have liked to have delved into more, but I just didn't have time. And so, yeah, I'm actually looking forward to a new challenge and new things to explore.
So how did this new role come about? Like, did you express an interest to the team that you were keen to do something like this? Or were they like, hey, Simon, we think you'd be great at this? Like, how did that start?
Yeah, I mean, for those who have been teammates with me know that I'm that techie guy. I've always raced my bike different to all my teammates. I always have it set up differently and have different things on it to make it faster and lighter mainly. And so, you know, the idea is to be able to put that effort into the whole team and not just myself. And I think maybe 3 years ago, I started getting onto the team saying the future of cycling is optimizing our equipment, because if that's not optimized, you're basically losing before you start the race. And funnily enough, I was telling them this when UAE was still riding with Campag and all their old equipment suppliers, and that off season was when they did their massive changeover to Envy and Shimano and new clothing and new tires. They went from Pirelli to Continental, and basically said, we don't care what it costs or whatever, we just want the best stuff. And they tested every wheel and every tire, and they just took the fastest stuff. And
hang on a sec. So Pog was winning with all the B grade stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
By a long shot.
Yeah. That's something we didn't know.
Sorry to interrupt.
Before he was winning, and we would watch him win, and now we don't even see him win because he's just completely gone. And so they were my case study, and I said to the team, "Look, that's the future of pro cycling, and the slower you take to bring on that mentality, the longer it'll take for us to catch up."
Did you speak to Koen De Kort as well? Is it what he's doing as well at Lidl? That's sort of what he's done as a transition, very similar to you.
Yeah, I think I don't know exactly to the extent Koen's day-to-day operations, but very similar, I believe. Lots of aero testing, material optimization. Also, I think Alex Dowsett in Astana does a similar role. But obviously, every team works differently. Some teams have sponsors where there's little movement, little possibility to change products and whatnot in some areas and more in others. For example, Trek don't make a TT helmet, so all the riders can ride any TT helmet on the market that's the fastest for them, and then they get it painted up in the team colours, whereas they have little choice in other areas. So it's a very team-specific role, depending on where you have flexibility. But fortunately, here in NSN, we have some great sponsors with Scott and Ekoi, who are very keen to work together in optimizing.
And so you will work directly with Scott, Ekoi, who I know them for the sunglasses, but they do plenty of other things. Clothing, you'll work directly with the company and say, we need to change this, or you need to change this because this is going to work better.
Yeah.
Wind tunnel stuff, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly right. And, I've been in Ekoi with this new helmet that came out at the Tour de France last year, which now all the teams have as of January, the new R Aero helmet. I was in there a year and a half ago with a 3D printed mold in my hand, looking at it, giving him feedback and things like that. So these sponsors really appreciate feedback from us, because we're pushing all of their material to the absolute limit. And if we can't break it, then often it's going to be okay for the public. The problem over the time is that a lot of teams and people struggle to be constructive in the way they give this feedback, instead of just ringing up their sponsor and saying that it's crap and it breaks or whatever. And so it's important to be very constructive in how you do that. But if you find a way to work well together, it can be a really good relationship.
I'm interested because, it's really cool that all the teams are focusing on this technology side. But at the same time, the UCI is actively, opposing that. They're trying to slow down the peloton through equipment regulations. How do you balance that strategically as a team when you're looking to optimize the equipment and you know that the UCI is trying to push that down?
Yeah, it's a challenge, but at the end of the day, it's our job to put together the fastest package possible within the regulations.
Yeah.
And I'm not at all against them trying to slow the peloton down, but until they do, or until they introduce methods to do so, we need to, as a team, to be competitive against other teams, maximize that as much as possible. And until those changes are made, we will keep pushing the limits, because if you're not, someone else is, and you know, that's just a bigger margin you have to the next team on the start line before the race begins.
I was just going to say, all we've talked about is your new job, which you haven't actually started yet. We need to celebrate your career. Christoph, lead the way.
We do, it's so interesting.
I love it. That's why I'm so keen to do this job, because
This is why this podcast is fantastic, because no one of us has a running shit, so we just run it. And then big shout out to Jean-Christophe and Céline at the Ecoy team. They work very close to us as well. Your career, this is something we want to talk about as well. 20 years on a saddle. We said in last week, I think it was, that you had several lives within the cycling, within your career in cycling. How was this last switch when you were about almost forced to retire? Then the new team happened, and then you had another few years and wins and so on. How does that feel when you place yourself back to that time?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. At the end of 2021, I was very close to retirement, but it would have been a forced retirement. I was nearly 35 already then, and as an age, that's probably also an adequate time to retire. And you've had a good career if you turn pro when you were 21 and whatnot. But personally, I just feel like I hadn't given my all, and I had more to give to the sport and more to achieve. And I really didn't take that well and didn't give up. I just kept on fighting. I had my team around me, my personal team of trainers and nutritionists and whatnot. And despite not having a team that off season, just stuck to my guns and followed the program of my group and made sure that when a team did come knocking, I could show them my training peaks and say, look, I'm ready to go tomorrow if you need me. Mm-hmm.
Did that period, that 3-month period, I suppose we could call it the off season till the end of Jan, because you signed end of Jan, I think. You had a manager ringing around, or how did it come about? And also, I guess the second part of that question, if you had have got to the end of Jan and there was no takers, were you prepared to sort of go, okay, I'm going to push through the season somehow?
Yeah.
Or would that have been it?
No. So I'm a big believer in you can't control what you can't control. And so I had a manager chasing teams. I also spoke to a few friends in the peloton trying to suss out if teams had spaces and whatnot. But I'm like, the biggest thing I can do is if a team comes knocking and I can show them that I'm ready to go and they have a spot, that they'll take me, because they can see that this guy's had uncertainty for the last 3 months, yet he's preparing as a World Tour rider does over December, November, December, January. And he's ready to go on day one if we need him. It's not like we're going to sign this guy and maybe we'll see him for the second half of the year. So, yeah, I just controlled what I could control. And then I always have a plan. So I just said, right, I'm going to prepare for nationals. I don't need a team to do nationals. I'd spoken to Cycling Australia about doing Tour Down Under and Cadell's race with the national team.
Yep.
And I was like, if that's it, they're my last three races. I'll give it until Cadell's race, that maybe a good result in one of those races in January might attract some attention. And then I'll go back to Europe after Cadell's race. And if nothing comes of that, then I'm done. And I'd already started having a few conversations. I even had a job interview in December to potentially go and get a job. So there was a few backup plans, but you know, I wanted to give it one last shot. And fortunately, Israel picked up the phone, and yeah, then I was just like, right, I need to pay these guys back for giving me the chance.
And how important was the, because you won at the Tour de France that same year, I think, if I remember.
Yeah.
An amazing win, by the way. I think we were all amazed by how you won that stage. How important was that stage win to making sure that all your decisions you made in January were right, the team was right, to seal that discussion that happened months before?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. But even before that, my very first race was in Mallorca, which is just past now, in late January. Mm-hmm. And I was fifth in the first Mallorca race. And then in the second one, I managed to climb with Valverde and Tim Wellens and come third in the next race I did in Mallorca. And I'd never climbed with Valverde and Tim Wellens on a 20-minute climb in my life. So I was already there, and they were the first two results of the team for the year. And so...
So you're off on a good...
Yeah, I was like, I'm...
Team.
And the funny thing was, I did a... With this preparation for Nationals, I was in Bright in the Victorian Alps, and I did a two-week camp there leading straight into Nationals and then... Or into Bakeritz. And during Bakeritz, the team rang me, and that's when everything happened. And they had a training camp in Girona starting in a couple of days, and they literally said, how quick can you get to Europe? We want you at the camp. Mm-hmm. And so I literally went from 2 weeks in Bright, Bakeritz, straight to Girona into another two-week camp. Mm-hmm. So I literally did a four-week training camp,
block.
And then I was like, if I'm not going well now, I've done something wrong. Yeah.
So that was after Nationals?
No, I didn't do any races.
Ah, okay.
They just rang me and said, come to Europe. And I was like, if you give me a job, I'll do whatever you want.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
So, yeah, I'd never end up racing. I did the couple of Bakeritz because
I remember
you
doing
that I was going. And then I felt bad if I pulled out at the last minute. So I said to the team, let me just stay for this weekend, and on Monday I'll fly to Europe, and on Tuesday I was on camp.
Wow.
I actually flew to Milan, dropped my family off in Italy. My mother-in-law packed me a suitcase from home and met us at the airport, and I left my mother-in-law, my wife and two kids. She gave me another suitcase, and I got on another flight to Barcelona and went straight
people
to
camp. People just don't know what's going on.
Yeah,
it's
chaos.
It is pretty crazy. I want to go back for a second. I know these stories have been told, but a lot of people haven't heard them, and we know the story about how you got into cycling through the Great Vic Bike Ride.
Yeah.
And I was flicking through this morning and just having a look, and two parts to it, which one was cute. There's a picture of you on your mountain bike with profile bars on, so the clip-on profile bars. You can say how old you were. And then also, I didn't realise you met Dean Woods.
Yeah.
On the great man who's sadly not with us anymore. But, I didn't realise. That was had a bit of an influence on you.
Yeah, massively. Back in the late 90s, the Vic Bike Ride had a kind of schools development program, and it was really well run with and a few notables would come along. Crackers Keenan was there from football, and then Dean Woods as an Olympic cyclist. And so when I did the riding on the Vic Bike Ride, I met these guys, and it was Dean Woods who actually came to me and said, you really should join a cycling club and get into this. And yeah, I kept in contact with him throughout my career, and always reminded him that he was the catalyst for me to get into cycling.
Does not every athlete, but it obviously helps. Well, we'll start with that. Does every athlete need someone like that, one person? And I'm curious of your take, Grace, because you came in late, but do you think each athlete who makes it needs at least one person like that, that says, you believed in me, and you sort of, you know, and you have obviously they become a mentor and what have you.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to be someone that becomes a mentor, but I think it's such a common story that people in sport have had that one person that's recognised their potential and said, it's worth you pursuing this. Like, it's hard for you as an individual to have that in your brain without some external input, I think.
Mm.
And, yeah, for me, it was actually a running coach that said, you know what, you'd make a really good cyclist.
Good running coach.
Yeah, my dad had been telling me to try cycling for a long time.
Well, you don't listen to that.
And I was ignoring him, but it was this other person that said, you know what, you've got a lot of power. It's not so good for running, but it
would be. I find that interesting that a running coach was able to identify, and they're obviously right, they're right about their assessment.
Did you have anyone, Michael?
No, I mean, my story was completely different because, you know, I'm 10 years older than you, Simon. We won't say how old that is, but my father raced. So it was all family. You know, it was old school way. You know, cycling was old school. It's a very old sport. My dad raced, so he was my inspiration. And then my brother's 5 years older than me. My brother went to Europe in the late 80s when there was five Aussies going to Europe. So that was just like, wow. You know, so that was... A lot of people from my era, that's how we got into it.
Even my era, I was one of the few racing when I was a junior in Australia that just got into cycling without it being in the family. And everyone I raced against, you know, their dad or parents or someone had raced, and they were just the next generation continuing in that sport.
And do you think a lot of that was because you then, you know, you went to Junior Worlds, you had good track results as well. I think we shouldn't sort of bypass that. You had some good results on the track. And I saw, I think, Junior Worlds result. You were 13th. Roman Kreuziger won. And there was a bunch of, there's about 10 names. I can't remember them all. I had a look again this morning. They're all retired. So you've beaten them all. Last man standing.
Eliminate
this is from Junior
race.
World. But there were some impressive names there.
Yeah. I came in that race. Geraint Thomas and I finished together.
He was 14th, actually.
Yeah. I sprinted him.
Got him.
I never let him forget that.
And he retired before.
He retired at the end of last year. And basically, I did too, but just extended it out to have a home race as well. And so, we raced a few times last year together and chatted about it and how, you know, we started together and now we're both finishing at very similar times. And, he's had an amazing career as well.
And now you keep doing battles with him. Because he's stayed on the Ineos into management.
Just on that, like, the length of your career and how it was when you started and how it is now, do you, like, what are the most significant differences that you see in the sport of cycling since you began?
In terms of longevity or just in general?
In terms of, like, the sport, what, you know, what the focuses were on performance when you began and now, like, you know, you're going into this new job where it's all about the tech and optimizing that and, like, every, you know, all the data's measured and it's very, very detailed.
Yeah.
Like, what do you see as, like, the evolution throughout your career?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose a rider that looked like they were super professional, maybe even when you were in your racing days, Marka, like, and they were a step above because they had a dietitian and they had a special mechanic that did everything. And now, like, that's the standard. You do that and you don't stand out anymore.
Yeah.
Which is great because it shows also where the sports come. And now, people are looking even further to get a one up on guys that are already very professional, and so you see things like this, a lot of heat training's taken off and all these other things that riders are trying to get, you know, raise the bar, and so that just becomes even more encompassing on your lifestyle and on the commitment to the sport. And you know, I think as a result, eventually that will shorten the length of riders' careers just because of how intense it needs to be if you need to be competitive at the top level.
Absolutely. Okay, we take a short break and then when we come back, we carry on chatting all about Simon Clark. Don't go away.
Stop. starting a new life in Australia isn't easy.
A lot of companies have rejected me.
Sometimes I feel like, oh, I'm gonna quit, I've given up.
Work in Progress is a podcast to help skilled migrants rebuild their careers in a new country. You'll hear inspiring real-life stories, expert advice, and valuable tips to help you find a job and advance your career. Work in Progress. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the SBS Cycling Podcast. Simon, you're still with us. I just want to go back to a few weeks ago, this last race in Geelong, the Cat Elevens Classic. It's a race that you had in your mind for the whole year, I guess, where you wanted to finish. How did you feel that morning when sort of everyone was giving you an accolade? You were mentioned at the front of the race. There was a lot of mention about you. It was a lot about you. How did that feel? Because you're pretty, you know, you're not necessarily an outgoing guy, but that was a lot of focus on you. How was it?
I had a lot of mixed feelings, actually, because, you know, I suppose a lot of cyclists, well, I suppose a high percentage of them don't get to retire when they want to retire and how they would like to retire.
And at home.
And at home. So I had, I feel very fortunate. I'm very appreciative to my team and also the race organisers at the Cadell Evans Great Ocean Road Race who supported this idea. And I feel very fortunate to have been able to do it there at my race, the closest race to home for me, and also Cadell, who's a very close friend. And, you know, I was there for the very first Cadell Evans race when he retired, and I thought it would be nice to also be able to finish there. So yeah, it was great to be able to have this idea and actually, you know, have it be realized. But at the same time, it had been over a year since we'd come to this agreement that we mm-hmm. would do this. And the hardest part of retiring is the period between when you decide to retire and when you actually do retire. Because, you know,
very long
the easiest thing is to decide the night before that the next day you're going to retire There's no window. So last year, you know, because I suppose I have a self-imposed standard of where I like to see myself as a rider, and I really had to push myself last year to make sure that I was still the professional that I expect myself to be, even though I know that it was the end of my career and I already had a contract signed, so I could have checked out and underperformed as I'd liked, and, you know, I could have still got through anyway, but that's just not me. And so, you know, I still did extra training camps and went away, and I was even in Bright for 2 weeks before Tour Down Under getting ready to race, because it's just how I'm wired, and I can't do it any other way.
Do you think you're going to miss it?
No. I love it. Don't get me wrong. I absolutely loved it. I wouldn't change anything of the last 20 years. But I also have that sensation that I gave everything. I've turned over every single stone.
Well, we talked about that. Almost not having a team. A lot of people don't realise. Right at the start of your career, you'd signed with Amica Chips. 3 months later, they went. They folded.
Yeah.
So it was a second time around. So you. It was, you know.
And then I was also in EF when they did that. GoFundMe page. Yes.
Right. I
was just out. Here we go again. Here we go again. But it just comes back to that.
I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor.
It just comes back to that. Right. You can't control what you can't control. Sure. In an ideal world, you're in a different team that doesn't have these issues. But in that, when you get to that point, you can't control that. And so, as you know, you can stress about it all you want, but ultimately, you know, you're not a rider isn't going out finding a sponsor for the team. So you just do what you can do and control what you can control. And yeah, I suppose having had this multiple times throughout my career, I was more optimistic when I got to 2021. I was like, oh, I've been here before. And if I stay professional, and, you know, that also with Amica Chips, I came out, you know, maybe subconsciously I learned something from that, because I finished top 10 in my first two pro races as a professional in La Guelia and Lugano, which are the first two races in February. And so as a neo pro, I at least showed that I'm not, you know, I can be competitive, and that definitely helped picking up a team later in the year when I was a 3-month professional without a team. And so maybe subconsciously I get to 2021 and I'm like, right, I've been in this situation before, and I showed in the first 3 months that I had a team, that I was ready to race and I was able to race at this level, and if I prepare an off season as a professional, then that'll set me up to keep going.
Is there, out of all your wins, all your successes, all your performance, one that stands out in your mind? If I can ask you, not the one you prefer, but the one that stands out.
Oh, I mean, nothing beats the Tour de France win. And obviously, because it's the Tour de France, it takes it to another level. But just like everything we've discussed, everything I went through that year.
And the pavé as well.
And yeah, on the pavé, getting a win like that just makes 20 years of sacrifice worthwhile from 1 second to the next. Is like, okay, now it was worth it. Doesn't matter what happens, it was worth it. Whereas missing out, like not getting a result like that, you've made all these sacrifices, but then you're always left with, you know, well, why did I never had anything at the end to really go, okay, that's why I did everything from...
Yeah, it's like, it's almost a real career affirming, but because you won in that year where you'd like started off without a contract and you really stuck to your values and sort of your mantra of like, this is me and this is how I go about challenges, and you got that win, it sort of just cements that as your, like, that defines your career.
Did you celebrate that win? Because a lot of the athletes say, we had this discussion many times where you guys don't celebrate. You're already wired up to the next one and the next one.
Yeah.
And you don't take time to appreciate.
Well, and I want to add to your question, if I may.
Yeah.
Along, it's sort of very similar, you know, because you're obviously very driven throughout your career, all the stuff we've talked about. But did you get into your room and go, what the hell's just happened the last 6 months? I didn't have a team. Like, was there a moment that you went, this is crazy what I've just done?
I mean, yeah, I suppose. I think the crazy thing is some of my biggest results have come off the back of setbacks. And it's like, why do I have to have such a setback before I can get these big results?
They're just testing you. Yeah. The people upstairs are just testing you.
Once you know, you know.
Yeah, it's like, do I have to break a leg before I can win something? Or?
I think setbacks give you clarity, though, don't they? It's like, because you knew that you just had to get a contract, you like, all the other stuff just gets pushed to the side and like, yeah, you focus down.
Yeah.
And then that's what gets the best out of you.
Yeah, I suppose you get like that nothing, a bit more of that nothing to lose mentality, because your back's against the wall. Mm-hmm. You can't go any further backwards. There's only forwards.
Like, you've got me. You've beaten me down.
You know, unless you're going through the wall.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then, you know, it just like, if you've got a 360 perspective, that suddenly is only a 180 perspective, because you can only go forward. And it's like, you change your focus to only forward thinking.
Sam, I wish I'd known that 20 years ago.
Are you listening?
Yeah, exactly.
My kids, are you listening?
Yeah. If we can just go back for a second also, because we talked about, Christoph asked you, you know, your biggest win, and obviously the Tour is it, or right up there, was assisting Cadel to win in Mendrisio. Was that possibly one of your greatest moments as a domestique? You know, national team. We hadn't had a world champion ever.
Yeah.
And you guys did it, delivered.
Yeah, I mean, the two that stand out are Cadel's world title in 2009 and Garrow's Liège, Bastogne-Liège win in,
of course,
in 14, I think it was. They're the two big ones where, Cadel, I spent the whole day at Cadel's side at the Worlds in Mendrisio, and you know, it was funny because, you know, I don't know if people know, but where he lived his whole career is not even 5Ks from that finish line. Like,
yeah.
He's actually, it was more of a home race for him than the Swiss people he was competing against. And I, at the time, was living in Varese in Italy, which is only not even 10 kilometers from the finish line either over the border in Italy. So it was literally, and you know, we train a lot together in that area, and it kind of felt like it was both of our home away from home race. And then we'd been paired together, the two of us looking after each other, taking on the world. So that was, it was a very special feeling that day.
Yeah.
But I look back on it and, you know, I was only 22. And here I am thinking I can help Cadell take on the world, and you know, it's incredible.
You did.
Ignorance is bliss, I say. Yeah. You know, like it's so easy as you get older in the peloton to say, "Oh, these young kids take too much risk or do these things," and I try and look at it from the other perspective and go, "Well, that was probably me once upon a time," and you know, it's actually nicer racing that way where you're not analyzing everything and looking at the risk that you're taking, and you're just getting out there and getting it done.
That's a good segue, actually. How much changing has changed on the saddle in a peloton? From the outside, we say it's going faster, it's going more aggressive. You've lived through it. Those young guys, Pogacar, Ayuso, all these young champions, how much have they changed the peloton and the way you race a race?
Massively. I don't think we do necessarily that many more watts than what we used to. But we do go miles faster. But I attribute most of that to equipment. You know, rim brake compared to disc brake. And what a lot of people don't realize is by having disc brakes, it's not the brakes that make you go faster, but how you can design the front of the bike, because you don't have to put a rim brake caliper.
Yeah.
You completely redesign the head tube and make it much more aerodynamic. And so we just, and then, you know, you think of the years, even I've seen pictures of you with it was just cool to wear the flapping jersey.
I've still got them.
Exactly. And like, you rock up with one of them in the pro peloton now, they just laugh at you.
Well, I flip it.
It's like, what, did you borrow someone else's jersey?
People have asked me, and I said, if anyone turned up in my era with a skin suit in a road race, you would kick them out of the peloton.
Really?
100%. 100%.
Yeah.
You know, I retired in 05. So, and I can tell you, it was after 05. It was, I can't tell you when exactly, but before then, if anyone wore a skin suit for a road race, you'd be like, what? Who is this?
Who is this guy?
Who's this Gumby?
Yeah.
Get him out.
But the big difference is not just one guy doing it or one guy.
Mm.
It's when you have 180 guys and they're all in skin suits and they're all on aero bikes and they've all got aero helmets, and that's what's changed. And so, you know, it's great. The early takers, sure, they were looking for marginal gains, but now we have 180 guys on a fast setup, and that's just...
It's the same in the women's peloton, isn't it? I mean, it's mirroring.
I think... some of the teams in the women's peloton aren't moving. Like, they don't have the resources to do all this development with their sponsors that the men's teams are doing, but there's a bit of a trickle-down effect as well.
Yeah.
Is there anything you're going to miss?
I'm not sure yet. For now, no.
we'll ask in 6 months.
You know, like I said, I really feel like I've loved every minute of the last 20 years. I've given everything. I've prepared for every grand tour with a 3-week training camp and altitude leading into it, so I'm not stepping away thinking, could I have done this, could I have done that? And you know, I've also got to a point where, although I love racing, I've got to a point where I don't enjoy being in the bunch and risking my life as like I used to. I suppose that also comes with me personally have become less competitive at the pointy end the last couple of years. And so then you question, or what, you know, if you can still be competitive, it justifies taking the risk. But if you're taking the risk and there's no potential reward at the end, which has been my situation the last little bit, then you start questioning, well, what am I doing here? Is it worth it? And, you know, that's why I'm so at peace with calling it now, and I'm ready to move on.
And home is Andorra. You're staying in Andorra. You're going back to Andorra. This is where you want to be for the next few years, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. We love living there, and the kids are in school there, and they really enjoy it. And you know, more than 50% of the riders on NSN live in Andorra, so mm-hmm. being close to them and getting feedback and chatting to them. And then we have our service course in Girona, which is only a few hours drive away. So it's a really good location while still being involved with the team.
And I mean, we're towards the end of this podcast. We could spend hours talking to you.
Yeah, but, I was going to say, we're pushing a record here. Phil Anderson was
absolutely.
You know, yeah. You're in the caliber.
We're going for a Joe Rogan 3 hour chat.
These two can tell you. Normally, I'm like, I'm
He's like, you've spoken enough. We're done.
But no, we carry on. I've got a few questions of myself. The addition of Birman Girmay in the team. What will this change? There's been a merger, we know, so Birman was able to be released and he's joined NSN. How much of an impact you think he can make in the team?
Huge. Particularly with the team losing the likes of Derek G and Matthew mm-hmm. Ricciatello, even though they're different types of riders, they were our leaders. And, you know, we definitely lacked a leader, an outright leader. I hope that we've got some really good young talent. Like we even saw Brady Kilmore this first month of racing really stepping up and putting his hand up. But to have a seasoned leader is very important. And I was conscious that we were looking like we weren't going to have a leader for this season. And with the points classifications being so important, you just can't afford to have a bad year, because that can put you out of the world tour, you know, in the next cycle. And so it's just amazing that we've been able to score Binny, not only to have a leader but to have a really good guy. He's a great contribution to this team, and you know, he's hit the ground running like I knew he would. I trained with him in the November. I took him to Valencia track for an aero test, and I was aero testing him, and then I kitted up and rode home with him because I was still a rider. So it's kind of double jobbing there. But he's a great guy, and he's super professional as well. And you know, I really hope I'm making a note of trying to figure out how we best support him, because he's a key to this team having great success this year.
He's a superstar. Mm-hmm. I love him from that. Yeah. He looks, he's what's the right word? Like he's a big guy. He looks powerful.
When you see him on the race, it's also what outside of the race, the supporters, the energy,
he's got X factor about him.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely.
The interesting thing for me is a lot of the North Africans that come to cycling, they're nearly all of the ones that I've ever raced against are all climbers. And
he's a rarity.
Although he's still quite skinny and doesn't look too dissimilar to them, then you do a sprint with him and he does 1800 watts. And you're just like, where the hell did this come from? And I did a sprint with him that day riding home from Valencia, and he just blew me away, and I was like, wow.
Yeah.
So it's,
was that your idea or his?
It's actually mine, because I wanted him to, he had a brand, he was just his first ride on the new Scott bike, and we were umming and ahhing about handlebar lengths and all this, and I wanted him to do a sprint to see how the bike felt, because we're actually chopping and changing between two frame sizes, and then obviously changing the handlebar length to simulate the same length, and we're trying to get a feel of which frame size he liked better. And I was like, well, it's pretty important that you know what it feels like when you're sprinting, considering that's your forte. And so I said, well, let's do a sprint, mate. So he's like, okay, I'll lead you out and then we can sprint. I was like, okay, so you'll lead me out and then I won't come off you. But we got a few sprints in and got an unofficial test of how the bike feels.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you for coming. I didn't ask the question, but Maka and I are wondering, what's your hair routine? You've got such a good quiff.
I'm obviously slightly jealous.
Yeah. I heard the cameras are going to be on today, so I'm like, I hope Mac has done his hair, because, you know.
He's done some good things around the years. Thank you for coming. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for listening to this podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be on, of course, next week. But thank you, Simon.
Starting a new life in Australia isn't easy.
A lot of companies have rejected me.
Sometimes I feel like, oh, I'm gonna quit, I've given up.
Work in Progress is a podcast to help skilled migrants rebuild their careers in a new country. You'll hear inspiring real-life stories, expert advice, and valuable tips to help you find a job and advance your career. Work in Progress. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.